from Germany, and of course quite a few from the United States. And so, and as I said, feel free to ask questions in the chat section or in the Q&A section at any time during the lecture. And the format will usually be about a 45, 50 minute lecture, maybe longer if I'm into something that I think is particularly important to the course. But I try to keep it to around there. And then depending on your participation, I'll sit here until 8 o'clock or a little after 8, although there are other classes with Mises Academy, so we can't stay here all night every Monday. But I'm willing to spend certainly until at least 8. But if you don't have questions, we'll cut it off earlier than that, or if you don't have many questions. And so I thought this is a good way to learn about what distinguishes the Austrian school from other schools of thought in economics, and also if you get into the literature of Murray Rothbard, you see the tradition of the Austrian school of economics in that understanding economics is just the first step. I put Rothbard in the same category as von Mises and Hayek and some of the older Austrians, in that he was very well schooled in economics and the history of economic thought and applied economics. He was a great applied economist, but also he was really deeply read in philosophy and history and the philosophy of science and other things. And von Mises was like that, Hayek was like that, and many of the other older Austrians were like that. And that really is part of the Austrian tradition. And it's, and when you read these people, at least when I started reading these people, I got the I always felt like they were obsessed with pursuing the truth. Whereas you know, my PhD is in economics, and most of the professors that I had in graduate school, and whose articles and books I was reading when I was in graduate school 100 years ago, I got the clear impression that their main objective was to impress people with how much math they thought they knew with their mathematical models, and even if the models had nothing whatsoever to do with the real world. But the Austrians always had this relentless pursuit of the truth, at least the most famous Austrians that we know of. And Rothbard was certainly in that group. And so it'll be fun kind of looking at Rothbard's take on the state, especially. And one of the things that really distinguishes Rothbard's analysis of the state is that most economists during his time, before his time, and today really look at themselves as potential advisors or potential advisors to a benevolent and omniscient state. And this, so if you take courses in economics and macroeconomics, for example, especially, is essentially a course in what kind of advice would you give a benevolent and maybe not quite omniscient state, but always a benevolent state. And there's very little analysis of the state. And now this sort of method was broken by the public choice school. And in my own background is some of my professors in graduate school in the 1970s were James Buchanan and Gordon Tullock, who are credited as being the inventors of the so-called public choice school, which is basically the economic analysis of political decision making. And so when the public choice school came around, it sort of it broke apart this methodology in the economics profession of always looking at markets as being flawed in some way, and then just assuming that government would straighten out or fix or correct the market failures. But Rothbard and Mises and Hayek and the other Austrians go much further than that. They really analyze government not as just another business firm, as some of the public choice scholars do. They analyze it really for what it is, and in Rothbard's view, it's a monopolist par excellence, the biggest monopolist that can be. And that, of course, is what he says in the first part of the article that I put on the reading list. Okay. Every once in a while, if you see me glancing down, I'm looking at the chat to see if somebody is saying something like, I can't hear, there's no volume or whatever. And so, or if you're asking me to say something over again, if you can't hear a word that I said, since we have people whose native language is not always English in the class, especially. Okay, so let's start on Rothbard's analysis of the state. And he calls it a monopolist extraordinaire. And so one of the first things he does is to point out the deep hypocrisy of the state of government in regulating monopoly. Governments almost everywhere have anti-monopoly laws. The United States has had them since the 1880s, for example. The 1890 was the first federal government anti-monopoly law. But when you think about it, almost everything the state does, it does as a monopoly. It has a monopoly in the police, it has a monopoly in the military. Local governments very often have monopolies in schools, in garbage collection, in fire protection, and all these things that they've commandeered. Years ago, when I used to write articles in the area of local public finance, part of my research was something called the International City Management Yearbook. Believe it or not, I used to read things like the International City Management Yearbook. But it was an interesting source of information about what local governments were up to in the U.S. And there was a particularly useful chart in there. Every year this thing would come out, and the chart listed how many cities, there were hundreds of American cities, small and large, and everything in between listed. And this is a chart of the percentage that contracted out with private companies to do various tasks that local governments did. Everything from leaf raking to schools to ambulance services to zoo maintenance, everything. And every single city in America had some positive percentage of these items that they were contracting out with private firms. And every activity, every single activity that local governments do, some of them rely on contracting out with private firms. And so what that suggests is that there's really nothing that you could point to that local governments do that really has to be done by local governments. They do it because they like to be monopolies. They like to commandeer monopolies. They like to be the garbage collection monopoly or the building maintenance monopoly, the school monopoly or whatever. Who doesn't? And they use the coercive powers of government to set themselves up in that way. And of course, they may allow a little bit of competition, such as in schools, but of course, it's very difficult to compete when your competitor has all of their capital costs and all of their operating costs paid for by the taxpayers. And so the governments don't really worry too much about private schools interfering with the government school monopoly. So when you look at what the government does, what the state does, just about everything it does do, it does as a monopolist of some sort. If not a total 100% monopolist, it competes in a grossly unfair way. For example, it is very routine for governments who do actually compete in something like garbage collection to impose all sorts of rules and regulations and taxes on the private companies, but exempt themselves from the same rules and regulations and taxes that impose very heavy costs on their private competitors. So even when they do allow competition, it's usually grossly unfair competition as far as that's concerned. And they're always working on making it even more skewed in their favor and more unfair in their favor, of course. So government is a monopolist extraordinaire. And Rothbard points out that governments always take over what are called the commanding heights of the economy. And he wrote this in an article decades ago, but after he wrote that, there was a video that I showed to some of my classes that is called The Commanding Heights. It's on YouTube. It was a PBS, Public Broadcasting System, series in the U.S., I don't know, maybe 12 years ago, something like that. And the first part of it is very good. Part one talks all about the great debate that took place in the early 20th century between John Maynard Keynes, the economist, and Friedrich Hayek. And the whole video is a discussion of the two alternative ideas, the central planner, John Maynard Keynes, versus the advocate of markets, von Mises, and Hayek. It talks mostly about Hayek, but it does mention von Mises and some other free market oriented economists such as Milton Friedman in the video. And I mention that because Rothbard himself uses the phrase commanding heights to talk about what governments always want to do. And so what are these heights? It's land and transportation is one of them. And so they always monopolize land. Of course, here in the United States, the government essentially claims to own all the land. You can buy property, but you have to pay property tax everywhere. And if you're late in your property tax, some local government has given it the right to take your property if you don't pay them tax on time. And there are various horror stories in the U.S. of some little old lady who is probably, her mind is not what it used to be, who lost the $500 property tax bill that came in the mail over Christmas, and she finds out that the government is about to take her house and sell it out from under her in order to get the $500 tax bill that is delinquent. Every year I read stories like that. And so, yes, you may own your house in a country like the U.S., but not really. And when the U.S. was being settled in the 19th century, the government came in and just claimed ownership to all the land. It's ours, the people who own the government. There was no real homesteading. The government claimed to own all the land. And so yes, we have property titles in the U.S., but because of the tax system, the property tax system, the government can come in and take your property from you if you don't pay them their tribute taxes. And of course, the government can set the tax rate. I'm living in Florida right now, and there has been a bit of an exodus of retired people from Florida into other states because the property taxes got too high during the real estate boom, and so they had to flee. They bought their retirement home, probably many of them in paid cash because they cashed in the profits from the homestead back home in some other state where they had lived for 30 or 40 or 50 years, but they found that even though they have no mortgage payment, they have a huge property tax payment, so huge that they can't live. And so they moved to North Carolina or some other state where real estate is cheaper and taxes are lower. So land and transportation, and the government always wants to control where we go. And so it controls the roads, the highways, the air, with air traffic control, and so forth. I saw this, I blogged about this a couple of years ago when I flew into Prague in the Czech Republic. The flight in to the airport, there seemed to be miles of high-rise apartment buildings there, which the communists had built. And then, of course, there's the tram. If you get around Prague, the communists built this train system called the tram. It's called that in many other cities as well. And it struck me that this was the ideal way for the communists to control the population. Herd them all into one section of the city in these massive high-rise and massively ugly high-rise buildings, and then when they travel to work or wherever, make them ride on the tram where they can be watched and controlled in terms of their movement. And here in the United States, there are a lot of governors and state government politicians who kind of like this system. They call it smart growth. And so they want to do, they're doing things that try to make it harder and harder and more costly to live in the suburbs or in the countryside in some states, because their goal really is to herd us into high rises in the cities where we can be taxed easier and controlled easier. And they want us to give up some of our cars and ride on government trains, just like under communism in the Czech Republic and everywhere else. And so it was true in the communist world, and it's still true today, although they, of course, have not succeeded, at least in the U.S., as they would like to succeed in this regard. The money supply, the government, is another commanding height. The government always wants to control the money supply. And, of course, we do it through the central bank here called the Fed in the United States, and most other countries have a central bank. And some of you know, I've written several books that tell really the whole story of the decades-long battle in American politics for government control of the money supply, beginning with Alexander Hamilton and my book Hamilton's Curse, and then followed up with my book on Lincoln called The Real Lincoln, and the second book on Lincoln called Lincoln Unmasked. Parts of those three books deals with the battle in American politics in the 19th century, all throughout the 19th century, to nationalize the money supply, right up to the creation of the Fed in 1913. And so it was a very long battle in the United States, but they finally did nationalize totally the money supply. In the post office, the mails, the government usually monopolized the mails, although of course technology has broken that up pretty well. The internet has broken up the postal monopoly. But in the United States, I can recall 30 years ago or so, 25 or 30 years ago, the government actually went after children, elementary school children, who had put Christmas cards in their classmates' mailboxes over Christmas because it's a violation of the Postal Express statute that gives the U.S. Postal Service a monopoly in first-class mail. So your seven-year-old child who would get a Christmas card or a Valentine's Day card and walk down the block and put it in the mailbox of his classmate or her classmate, their parents were threatened with prison and fines for violating the Postal Express statute. But then along came fax machines and the internet and email and Twitter and everything else. And so that monopoly has been pretty much broken up, although the government really does hate it, doesn't it? Here in the U.S., Senator Lieberman and a few others have been several times have proposed legislation to give the government the right to shut down the internet under some emergency scenario. And Rothbard remarks that, yes, we have freedom of speech and freedom of religion. The government seems to have taken a step back on that, especially freedom of religion. Americans can worship freely. I think the main reason is that they know it doesn't matter. And also, religion can be captured and influenced by the government. There are many, many churches in the U.S., for example, where the preachers and the rabbis and the other people in these places of worship are very political, and they get their flock and they rally them behind this or that politician, and the politicians kind of like that. And so so we don't really have total freedom of religion. It is influenced by politics, and we don't really have total freedom of speech. My old friend Robert Higgs, who some of you know about, author of the famous book Crisis and Leviathan, among many others, once said to me that the reason why we have free speech, why the government allows us to have free speech, is it knows it doesn't really matter. We can talk all at once, but it has such monopoly power that it can still do whatever it pleases, regardless of what we say. But then again, we don't really have free speech. In a heavily regulated economy like the U.S. economy, business people don't really have free speech, because if you speak up too much against the government can go after you with taxes, with government regulations. You have to deal with government bureaucrats at all levels, federal, state, and local, on a daily basis. If you're in any kind of significant business in the United States and in most other countries, and they can always take revenge on you if you're too anti-government. And so most business people hold back and shut up and say nothing and run away if anyone in their presence does say anything too critical of government. Even the business people who fund or finance or donate money to various think tanks or organizations that do critical analyses of government programs, a lot of them are sort of in the shadows and are hard to find. They set up foundations and they don't directly contribute the money themselves, because they don't want to be tagged with anything that's too overly critical. And of course, the organizations that they fund usually pull their punches as well, because they don't want to upset their sources of funding. And so the state, if you have a regulated economy, you cannot have free speech. Business people will be denied free speech to a very large extent. Of course, the biggest, the most important monopoly government has is the monopoly on violence, and that's why governments always monopolize the police and the military. And even though in the United States there are more private police than there are government police, there are so many private security guards and private police who at shopping malls and gated communities and so forth, there actually are a greater number of them than there are government police. But the government police, of course, have a much more of a monopoly of force than any private security guards, many of whom cannot even carry firearms, for example. They can call the real police, they can call the government police, but they just kind of parade around and look like police. And of course, there's the military monopoly that the government has in early America. One of the interesting episodes of early American history that I wrote about in my book, Hamilton's Curse, was something called the Whiskey Rebellion. And this was a tax revolt in the state of Pennsylvania, in western Pennsylvania, in the early 1800s, late 1700s, actually. And it was put down by America's first Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton himself. And he and George Washington, who was president, about some 15,000 conscripted soldiers to ride into Pennsylvania and to put down this tax rebellion. And when I read about this and learned about this, it really impressed upon me the real reason why the American founding fathers, most of them, did not want a standing army at all, and that they understood that all throughout European history, standing armies were used to intimidate the domestic population. They weren't used to defend against foreign aggressors. Their purpose was to intimidate the people, to make sure the people complied with the king's regulations and paid the king's taxes. That's what the standing army was for. And so that's why the original U.S. Constitution only allowed for the funding of an army for 2 years, because they didn't want a standing army. But of course, that has all gone by the wayside, and we do have a standing army, and it is becoming more and more involved in local law enforcement with so-called homeland security in the United States. Rothbard, of course, takes a very different view of the state than the public choice economists, and certainly than the so-called mainstream economists, in that he points out that basically the business the state is involved in is theft and slavery. Theft, because taxation is legalized theft. Friedrich Bastiat, the great French economic journalist of the 19th century, is said to have coined the phrase legal plunder to describe much of what the state does. And that certainly is a good phrase, legal plunder, legalized plunder. And also slavery, because after all, what would you call it, or what else would you call a system whereby one person is threatened with violence to work for the benefit of another person? You know, violence and intimidation and threats of violence are used to force one person to work, not for himself, not for his family, but for the benefit of another person. Well, that seems to me to be a perfect definition of slavery, but that is exactly what the welfare state is. Income taxation is a system whereby I, for example, would be forced by the government to live in a cage with a toilet with no walls for maybe 5 or 6 years if I quit paying the state's income tax. And so I am literally forced with imprisonment in a cage unless I work for the benefit of somebody else for maybe 5 months out of the year. The average American works all through April and into May nowadays. If you add up all the taxes that we pay, the average working person realizes what the Tax Foundation in Washington, D.C. calls Tax Freedom Day. It doesn't come until early May, I think, in recent years. And that just counts taxes. That doesn't count the implicit tax of government regulation that makes the goods and services that we consume cost more. It doesn't also include the implicit tax of price inflation caused by the Fed's creation of new money. And so if you count price inflation created by the Fed and the propping up of prices by government regulation, the average American probably works half a year just to pay taxes. Okay, I see somebody is putting links in there, which is great. The Commanding Heights, very good. Okay, and so that's Rothbard's argument about the government essentially being a system of legalized theft and slavery, because the Eighth Commandment says, thou shalt not steal. It does not say, thou shalt not steal, unless you call stealing something nice like social justice or democracy. It doesn't say that. It says, thou shalt not steal. And taxation really is legalized stealing, no matter how you try to sugarcoat it. And there's a long history of economists and others trying to make arguments that taxation is really voluntary. That it's it's not really coercive, it's voluntary somehow. Among the worst examples of this is my old professor James Buchanan of public choice fame. He devoted much of his career, maybe the last 30 years of his career, to writing many books and articles, trying to create something called a voluntary theory of the state. And he started out recognizing that, first of all, nothing that the state does, it does unanimously. So to be voluntary, you need unanimity. That's why the free market is voluntary. If I buy something from you and we do it voluntarily, there's no fraud, there's no force or coercion, then there's unanimous agreement between you and me that we think this is a good deal for both of us. You take my money, I take your goods, we're both happy, we both say thank you, and we go our way. That's the market. And so there's Buchanan and others, there's a whole field or this subdiscipline called constitutional economics, and this is part of it. Part of it is to try to attempt to construct what they call a voluntary theory of the state, which is sort of a Don Quixote type enterprise, in my opinion. And so they started out recognizing, of course, nothing government does is unanimous. Even in the small governments, they use majority rule, or even qualified majority. And then they ended up saying, well, qualified majorities are better than slim majorities. 67% is better. But still, the 67% gets to abuse or exploit the rest. So it's still exploiting a minority. And so they realized that they couldn't come up with a voluntary theory of the state by praising 67% majorities or even 90% majorities. And so they came up with the notion of conceptual unanimity. And there's a whole body of literature here in this so-called constitutional economics that simply spins tall tales about how conceptually you could conceptualize a situation where everyone would agree to be taxed for the benefit of society, for something, for national defense or something like that. They don't say that this ever actually happened in the real world, in all of world history. They just say you can conceptualize that. And the economist Leland Yeager wrote an article about this in the Cato Journal maybe 20 years ago or so. There was a really good critique of it. I don't have the reference at my fingertips now. Maybe I'll plug it into the class information later. But the most trenchant point he made is that whenever you hear these people talking about conceptual unanimity with regard to government behavior, just substitute the word no for conceptual and you know what they're talking about. No unanimity. Walter Block and I co-authored an article about this in a journal called the Journal of Institutional and Theoretical Economics some years ago. I'll dig that up also and put the reference on the site for the class, unless one of our crack web guys like Cam Ray can find it online somewhere. But it discusses in great detail this whole idea that government can somehow be voluntary. And of course, Rothbard said it much earlier than Walter Block and I did. And so the argument is also made sometimes that, well, voting makes taxation voluntary, government voluntary. But of course, voting is never, in city elections in the United States, if they get a 10% voter turnout, that's a big deal, that's good. And even the presidential election, if they get 55% voter turnout, that's record-breaking. And so in no way is voting unanimous at all. There's a famous quote by Benjamin Franklin, one of the early American founding fathers, about government. If you were to Google, you can find it. If you just go online and type in Benjamin Franklin on democracy, it might pop up as the first one where he said, democracy is two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for lunch. And that's a pretty good definition of what democracy is. It's anything but unanimous. In fact, in addition to the fact that we never have 100% voter turnout, and even if we did, we never get 100% vote on anything. The government plays all kinds of games, such as log rolling. You might have something that is very unpopular, that only a very tiny minority of a community wants the government to do. And so if you were to take a vote on that thing, say raising taxes to build another school, you might only get a tiny minority of a vote and it would never pass. However, there are other people in the community who want things from government also. And so their representatives log roll. They'll go to the small group, maybe 20% of the community who wants more government spending on schools, and they'll say, you know, we could use your votes. If you can vote for our thing, which you don't care about at all, when the vote on more schools spending comes up, we'll vote for more. We will organize votes by the thousands for more school spending, even though we don't really care about more school spending. And so what you get a lot of times with democracy is not majority rule, but a collection of minority special interest groups who trade votes with one another, and the end result is a collection of legislation that really is not a majority of anybody's preferences, but just a lot of horse trading and log rolling, as it's called in politics. And the government also plays games like agenda control. For example, if a vote is taken on more school spending, and it's voted down, it's not unusual for the school system, the government school system, to say, okay, no more school buses this year. Parents, you have to drive your kids to work every single day all year long, or have them walk to work, which in the United States is terrifying to a lot of parents, depending on where they live. And so they then take another vote, and the parents buckle in, taxpayers, buckle in, buckle under, as the saying goes, and they cave in and vote for the tax increase. It's a sort of a thinly veiled form of extortion. And it's called, even in the literature of public choice, it's called agenda control. One type of voting that Rothbard did approve of, and he quotes Lysander Spooner as saying that even voting, you're basically trying to vote yourself somebody else's income, but voting as self-defense against plunder is meritorious. So if you do vote and you vote no against all the proposals to spend more money that would plunder you as a taxpayer, Rothbard's view is, well, that's okay. If you're going to vote, that's a good way to vote. Rothbard also was well-schooled in the classical liberal tradition, and he quotes a famous book by Franz Oppenheimer entitled The State, which I would recommend to everyone to read at some point. It's a great old classic. Franz Oppenheimer was a sociologist of the last generation, and his book is A History of the State. He writes about how what is called the conquest theory of the state, about how it's sort of a sociological and anthropological study about how states historically were formed basically by one criminal gang being more vicious and more criminal than all the other gangs in society, and call itself government. And so the states were created by conquest. There was never this happy day where people all got together and agreed voluntarily to tax themselves to provide public goods. That's all a myth and a fairy tale that everyone is miseducated about when they take principles of economics or some other courses that tell this fairy tale at the university level. But that's how states really were formed. And Oppenheimer recites the old classical liberal truth that there really are only two ways to earn a living in society. One is to try to have a business or to participate in some sort of business or organization that provides goods and services to your fellow man in return for money, in return for payment of something from your fellow man. And so it's voluntarism in the free market. The other way of making money is fraud, theft, and coercion. And so you can classify criminality under that. You could be a robber or a burglar or a mugger, that sort of thing, a criminal, or you can be a politician. Politicians essentially use fraud, they lie all the time, theft, taxation, and coercion, threats of imprisonment if you don't pay their taxes, to get money. So you can get money that way. So if you're a private citizen and you lobby the government for protectionist tariffs or subsidies of certain types, you're using the system of fraud, coercion, intimidation, and violence to make money, as opposed to the voluntary way of making money in the free market. And so that's how to characterize the state. And so as you can see, if you start thinking of the state as it truly is this way, it really seems farcical for an economist to view himself or herself as some sort of honest advisor to these well-meaning politicians who will take your advice and simply do what's good for the public interest. That's essentially how most economists view themselves. Of course, they view themselves also in a way that where they see there's a potential to make money by being paid as a consultant to the Fed or some other government agency, so there is money involved there. It's not just dupedism on the part of economists. And so in speaking of economists, Rothbard talks about the ideological minions, where he makes the point that in his essay, The State, that governments, even the most totalitarian government, like the Soviet Union, the people who run the government were greatly outnumbered by the population. And so they did to control the population by having a monopoly of violence. They had the military as a monopoly, and the police, and the secret police, and the spies, and all that. But still, they were outnumbered by many, many, many millions of people who could easily have overwhelmed them at any time, just in sheer numbers, as far as that is concerned. And so in order to deter that sort of thing, of course, the communist government did use a lot of violence. They murdered millions of their own citizens. But that's pretty costly. And it also threatens to break up the facade of the benevolence of socialism. And so even the worst tyrannical governments of the world always relied on some sort of ideology and what Rothbard called the ideological minions who tried to sort of lie to the public and tell the public all these tall tales about the alleged benevolence and omniscience and paternalism of the state, and at the same time of the evils and uncertainties of the private sector, the civil society, and especially the free enterprise, in order to make the case that you need government as your protector against the evils of voluntarism and the civil society. And so, essentially, to make murderers and thieves look like angels is the role of the ideological minions. And there's a quote that I'd like to read. It's worth reading. It's one of my favorite Rothbard quotes on this point in his essay, The Nature of the State, where he says, "It is precisely the function of the state's ideological minions and allies to explain to the public that the emperor does indeed have a fine set of clothes. In brief, the ideologists must explain that while theft by one or more persons or groups is bad and criminal, when the state engages in such acts, it is not theft, but the legitimate and even sanctified act called taxation. The ideologist must explain that murder by one or more persons or groups is bad and must be punished, but when the state kills, it is not murder, but an exalted act known as war or, quote, repression of internal subversion. That's a good thing. They must explain that while kidnapping or slavery is bad, it must be outlawed when done by private individuals or groups. And when the state commits such acts, it is not kidnapping or slavery, but conscription, an act necessary to the public will and even to the requirements of morality itself. The function of the statist ideologist is to weave the false set of the emperor's clothes to convince the public of a massive double standard. That when the state commits the gravest of high crimes, it is really not doing so, but is doing something else that is necessary, proper, vital, and even in former ages, not today, in former ages, by divine command. The age-old success of the ideologists of the state is perhaps the most gigantic hoax in the history of mankind. And so again, if you believe in that, if that makes sense to you, then economists who look at themselves as advisors to benevolent despots really are fools, and they're fooling themselves, to be sure. There's another quote, at the risk of making the thing boring by reading to you. This is just too good to pass up. What Rothbard in the next page says about why ideology is so important to all states, whether it's the former Soviet Union or the United States today or Brazil or Germany or Mexico or the Netherlands or any state, ideology is an important part of it. It props up the state. Here's what he says. The reason that ideology is so vital to the state is that it always rests, in essence, on the support of the majority of the public. This support obtains whether the state is a democracy, a dictatorship, or an absolute monarchy. For the support rests in the willingness of the majority to go along with the system, to pay the taxes, to go without much complaint, to fight the state's wars, to obey the state's rules and decrees. This support need not be active enthusiasm to be effective. It can just as well be passive resignation. And I'm going to stop there to add another paraphrase of David Hume, the famous philosopher. One of the things he said was that when he was arguing on this very point, was he said, just because the conscripted sailor does not commit suicide by jumping overboard, that does not mean that he agreed to being conscripted in the first place. He didn't kill himself, but that doesn't mean he agreed, therefore, to being drafted or conscripted into the Navy. And then Rothbard, going back to Rothbard, he says, but support there must be, for if the bulk of the public were really convinced of the illegitimacy of the state, if they were convinced that the state is nothing more or less than a bandit gang writ large, then the state would soon collapse to take on no more status or breadth of existence than another mafia gang. Hence the necessity of the state's employment of ideologists, and hence the necessity of the state's age-old alliance with the court intellectuals, sometimes called court historians, who weave the apologia for state rule. And you could all think of examples, of who these people might be in the society in which you live. Who Rothbard is referring to. They're on television all the time. They teach you at their universities. They write articles in newspaper columns and so forth. That's who he's talking about. And in terms of the role of journalists here, on this thing that I just read about by Rothbard, there's an article of mine on lewrothwell.com you might be interested in. It's entitled Be Patriotic, Don't Vote. And it sort of echoes what Rothbard is saying here. My argument is not original to me. Lysander Spooner made a similar argument. Le Baudier, a French philosopher of the 1500s, made the same argument. Rothbard did. So my article is just sort of an updated version of this argument, in my words, as far as that goes. Another point I'd like to make here in with regard to Rothbard's discussion of ideologists in the state is that there were two economists at the University of Rochester years ago named Michael Jensen and William Mecklen. Jensen is a famous corporate finance economist. He taught at Harvard after that for many years. I think he's a professor emeritus at Harvard now. I'm pretty sure he's retired, but he's probably still professionally active. And I think Mecklen may have passed away. He was the dean at the University of Rochester in the 1970s. But they wrote a very interesting article way back when in one of the finance journals on the role of journalists. And they pointed out that a very common sense sort of a public choice argument that think of this, if you're a journalist anywhere and you're covering, say, labor issues, that's your thing, you're given the assignment of covering labor issues, where do you get most of your information? You probably get most of your information from the government's Department of Labor. In the U.S., we have a U.S. Department of Labor. State governments have state government departments of labor. That's where you get most of your information. And so if you are too overly critical of government policy, you as a journalist get cut off from the information flow, and you cannot have a career. Your career is ruined. If you're an environmental reporter, where do you get most of your information? From the Environmental Protection Agency, or from the state government version of the Environmental Protection Agency. And once again, if you get too critical of them, you'll get cut off, and your career is ruined. You cannot have a career. And so, and the state uses this monopoly of information about government policy to manipulate the media. And so the journalists are, there are some exceptions in the U.S. and elsewhere, but for the most part, they are the ideological lapdogs of government bureaucrats. They might publish every once in a while very, very mild and marginal criticisms just to create the false impression that they are objective, when in fact they are really not. But whenever some politician comes around who really challenges the essence of the state as a thieving criminal enterprise funded by counterfeiting through the Fed or the central bank, someone like Ron Paul, for example, well, the journalists go kind of crazy, don't they? For the most part, and so they don't want those people even to be allowed to be known in polite society, for the most part, at least not anywhere near an election anyway. And so that was Jensen and Minkling's argument, and I think it falls in very nicely with what Rothbard is saying here about the ideological minions. It's journalists, for the most part, although there are some exceptions. And once again, that's why the internet is so important. That's why, if I can blow our own horn, why groups like the Mises Institute are so important. We no longer have to go through the gatekeepers to get the word out. We can go online. We can teach courses like this. You don't have to go through the gatekeepers at the university to learn economics anymore. You don't have to go through the gatekeepers in journalism school to be a journalist. You can be a blogger. Every one of you could be a blogger, and you should. Okay. And the final thing that I'll mention on this particular essay is how Rothbard points out the absurdity of some of conservatives who think that it's a good idea for the state to enforce morality, the government. I mean, isn't that something? When the state, I try to put an ugly face on it, like the late Ted Kennedy or Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, the enforcer of morality. When the state passes laws telling us how to behave, when the state passes laws saying to be married you must have the state's permission. Marriage was always a matter between the individuals and their churches and the civil society. It was only in the past 100 years or so, or a little longer than that, the state started taking over marriage and requiring marriage licenses and all this sort of thing. But in previous generations, it was a matter of, between individuals or individuals in their church, period, civil society. One other point I'd like to make here is the second article that I put on the syllabus, the online article, there's some overlap with the first, but the second half of that one is all different material. And so the part that starts with a subtitle section called The Inner Contradictions of the State. And there's one more quote that's worth mentioning here that Rothbard makes about the argument that the state can be somehow voluntary. And here's what he says. He says, here's a typical argument for the state. And the argument goes as follows. If each of us is allowed to remain free in all aspects, and particularly if each of us is allowed to retain weapons and the right of self-defense, then we will all war against each other and society will be wrecked. Therefore, let us turn over all of our guns and all of our ultimate decision-making power to define and enforce our rights to the Jones family over there. And so he's talking about the creation of some government. This could be, to the British royal family, whoever the state is, the Jones family. Okay, the Jones family will guard us from our predatory instincts. They will keep social peace and enforce justice. So that's the argument. And then Rothbard is going to say, is it conceivable that anyone, except perhaps the Jones family itself, would spend one moment considering this purely absurd scheme? The cry of, who would guard us from the Jones family, especially when we are deprived of our weapons, would suffice to shut down such a scheme. And so, you know, okay, a society without government will lead to a warfare among gangs, and then one big gang will take over, the theory goes. Therefore, we should pick a gang and give them a monopoly of violence. But then the obvious question is, well, who then's going to protect us? We give up our guns, we give up our ability to protect ourselves. Who will protect us from them? And of course, that's sort of the situation Americans are in now, where the government is pretty much unlimited and can do whatever it wants. And Rothbard was is probably the most famous critic of the whole idea that limited government is possible, limited constitutional government, sort of the mantra of conservatives, especially limited. They say they want government to be limited, but very strong and powerful in the things that it does in a limited way, which has got to be one of the biggest oxymorons or contradictions in terms in the history of the world, not to mention being ahistorical. It's because, you know, as Rothbard points out, no government has ever remained limited. No constitution has ever limited government. The U.S. Constitution, if history teaches us anything, has been a complete and absolute failure in limiting government. It's been a long, long time since there were any limits on government imposed by the U.S. Constitution. The whole thing has been reinterpreted by the government courts over the past 150 years to essentially rubber stamp anything the government ever wants to do ever about anything. As Andrew Napolitano pointed out in his book, The Constitution in Exile, the U.S. Supreme Court did not rule against a single federal law as being unconstitutional from 1937 to 1995, all that time, and very few things since 1995. And so it essentially is a rubber stamp institution that just rubber stamped socialized medicine, didn't it? Where's that in the U.S. Constitution? Nowhere. But they called a fine a tax, which of course is not a tax, a fine, and that's apparently sufficed to make the legalistic argument that somehow the founding fathers didn't realize that socialized medicine was in the Constitution somewhere. Another thing that Rothbard sort of pokes fun at is the idea of conservatives that in an ideal world, government would serve as sort of an umpire. They even call it the night watchman state. My old professor, James Buchanan, used to like this term, this phrase, the night watchman state. But how would that be? How would the state ever sit back and not aggrandize itself, not grow, not take more money from us, not plunder us, and just sit back and be a neutral referee, happy with the money that we give it? That has never happened in all of world history. There's no reason to believe it happens. And as Rothbard points out, power corrupts. You give government power to tax us and to legalize counterfeiting power with the central bank, it's going to use that power for its own benefit. It's not going to use it for our benefit. It's going to use it for our own benefit. And so I think I'll stop there as far as my summary of some of Rothbard's main arguments on the nature of the state. Because he does get in this second article I put on the syllabus for tonight, to John C. Calhoun. And for next week, I put a reading by Calhoun, who was one of Rothbard's favorite American political philosophers, in his famous book, A Disquisition on Government, which was written in 1850. It's considered to be sort of one of the last works of the libertarian wing of the American Founding Fathers, which was the Jeffersonian wing. The Hamiltonian wing was the statist wing of the American Founding Fathers, but the Jeffersonian wing was the libertarian wing. And Rothbard quoted John C. Calhoun in many of his writings and thought very highly of his intellect. And so I don't want to steal any of my own thunder for next week. And so I think I'll stop there, and I just wanted to present my take on what the main points that Rothbard makes about the nature of the state. And then we're going to continue on. You know, some of the other lectures will be very different than this one, because Rothbard, as most or all of you know, was really a top-flight brilliant economist, among other things. I mean, he wasn't just a libertarian philosopher. That was almost a sideline of his. And so his analysis of the economics of government taxing and spending, and his analysis of monetary theory, which we're also going to talk about those things, his economic analysis of bureaucracy, of government bureaucracy, is very good. And so we're going to talk about all these things in future classes. And you can't cover all of Rothbardian analysis of a state in only 8 weeks. You could easily teach a semester-long university course, but these are some of the highlights I'm going to try to hit. And so for the rest of this class, I'm going to look and see if there are any questions for me under the Q&A or anywhere else, and I'll be glad to do my best to answer all of them if I can. So I'm going to just start looking here. See what we have on the chat. Let me see if I get on the Q&A. Let's see, here's a question from John Lepari. Did Rothbard think that the reason for government monopolies were inherently malicious or pure ignorance in regards to the efficiency of the private sector? Well, I think you don't have to be an economist to realize that the private sector is inherently more efficient as long as there's competition than government bureaucracy. So I think Rothbard's opinion was certainly that, being a student of history, he understood that government took over even such things as the law. In his essay that I put on the syllabus for tonight, he points out that the law was originally a private enterprise. There were private adjudicators. The laws of the sea were private centuries ago. There were merchant laws, merchant marine laws that existed. And then the government came in and took these over. Even in the case of the American West, when it was unsettled and the pioneers were going west, and there were not even states yet, they all set up their own constitutions. They hired their own private security guards. They hired their own guards to guard their cattle ranches and so forth. And then governments came along and monopolized everything and started taxing everybody to pay themselves to be monopoly law enforcement businesses, whereas there was law enforcement. A famous article about this, at least famous among my crowd, is The Not So Wild Wild West by Terry Anderson and P.J. Hill. It was in the Journal of Libertarian Studies in 1979. And so that's one example. There are also several other books on this topic. There's an article of mine in the Independent Review a year and a half ago or so, entitled Violence in the American West, Myth versus Reality, where I talk about this similar thing. And so there's another book called Order Without the State that I would recommend. And so Rothbard doesn't think that people were just ignorant when they established government monopolies. They were imperialists. Another question, Rothbard used the phrase commanding heights. He didn't comment on the video that I mentioned, the commanding heights, but in the article, The Nature of the State, that I put online for this course, he uses the phrase, the commanding heights, to describe the land and transportation system, the post office, the monetary system, the governments. Those are the commanding heights that governments have always taken over. Okay. I did write an article on the Winston Rebellion. It's a part of my book, Hamilton's Curse, part of a chapter of my book, Hamilton's Curse, on the Whiskey Rebellion. Although I do recall a couple of good articles on the Whiskey Rebellion, I think on Mises.org or LouRockwell.com. Maybe Cam can find them. And so that's where I would look. I can, after the class, I can dig these up too. This question says, don't most government workers, especially bureaucrats, honestly believe that they're doing good work? It would be a gas to be accused of plunder. No, they understand that what they're doing is grossly inefficient. But yeah, it's not the individuals themselves. It's a system, which we're going to talk about in a couple of weeks, of incentives that makes government bureaucrats so grossly inefficient. In a nutshell, to give this sort of advanced advertising, the market system, effort and reward are connected. There's a market feedback mechanism. Good performance is rewarded with profits. Bad performance is penalized with losses or bankruptcy. that does not exist in the government sector, because there is no way of measuring profit and losses in an accounting sense in the government sector. There simply isn't profit and loss statements, there are only budgets. And so there's no way of significantly rewarding good behavior. There's no way of even finding out whether or not they're catering to consumers in a very good way. And vice versa, there's no way of penalizing bad behavior. In fact, with government, failure is often rewarded. The worst job the government bureaucrats do at educating children, feeding the poor, et cetera, the more money they give themselves routinely. So failure is success in the government, and it's not the individuals themselves, it's the system that is the problem. You can get these same people, same individuals, get them out of a job working for the local city government garbage collector and put them on a private garbage truck, and they'll be much more efficient because they have to be to keep their job. And so it's not the individuals. Question from Gordon Clark. Do you think that we passed the tipping point of government completely controlling our lives, or is there some way of reversing this growth? Well, it depends on what country you live in, I guess. If you're talking about the United States, I think government is now unlimited. I don't see anything that's going to limit government other than secession and a number of states or groups of states dropping out of the Union at some future time peacefully. Other than that, government is unlimited. The Constitution has been a dead letter for many, many years, generations, in fact. And elections certainly don't limit anything in any significant way. And so, that's the only thing I can see. Although, you know, the Soviet Union collapsed through numerous acts of peaceful secession. And I think that's what will have to happen here. See, I have my fan on my laptop is making some noise. Somebody says that. Did Rothbard believe in the objectivity of law? Matt Flaherty asked. Well, I'm not sure about the objectivity of law, exactly what you mean, but I do know that in his writings about private law, it was usually private, how it worked was private judges were hired to adjudicate some dispute. And they would use sort of the common wisdom of the day in terms of what appeared to be fairness and justice and accuracy in adjudicating a situation, and they would adopt that as opposed to legislation. And legislation is just the result of one larger gang ganging up in a smaller gang, the larger gang being the majority, the smaller gang being the minority in politics. But the common law, as it evolved privately, was very different than that. And so it was bound to be much more objective and based on facts and reality than on politics, because it wasn't based at all on politics. It wasn't a part of government. Let's see, there's a question on differences in views of Rothbard and Hans Hoppe on the origins of the state. I don't think there's any difference. Hans Hoppe he's probably the truest and bluest Rothbardian in the world today, and so I don't think you'll find any difference on this. Read Hoppe's book, Democracy, the God that Failed. It's totally an exercise in Rothbardian social analysis. And I'm going to go back to the chat now and see if I can get any other questions from the chat. I'm not sure what the problem is with the fan on my laptop here, so I need somebody complaining about it. Okay. Yeah. I don't really see any questions here yet. Yeah, I'm still looking at the questions, and let's see. A lot of commentary. Okay, I see the Mises Institute found my article with Walter Block on Is Voluntary Government Possible? I'll have to switch laptops, I guess. And I don't know what to do about it. It's a laptop with a fan, so I don't know what to do about it. It's a problem. Let's see, Brian Wazaki, is there a difference between a state and a government? Some writers have done that. I think Bastiat, in the law, his famous essay, The Law, distinguished between government and the state. But it's kind of nebulous. I think for practical purposes, I don't think we should think of it as being different. And let's see. Yeah, I missed one. See, can it not be argued that all these small private governments lack economies of scale? Well, that actually used to be object of research among public choice economists. In fact, I wrote my doctoral dissertation on this topic a thousand years ago, in general. The argument was made back in the 60s and then part of the 70s that it's good to have lots of governments, or bigger governments rather than lots of small ones, because they can have economies of scale in producing goods and services. But there were a bunch of statistical studies done by other people who found that it's not true, that the bigger governments, bigger means more bureaucracy and more waste and more cost. And so the bigger governments did not have economies of scale, they had diseconomies of scale. So they were worse, they were monopolists, in other words. So if you lived in a place like, say you lived in, I'll just pick Chicago, Illinois, and you had 30 different local jurisdictions where you could live in any one of them. Some of them were high tax jurisdictions and some of them were lower tax jurisdictions. Well, the competition, the argument would go between the jurisdictions for population and for business would be a thing that would hold down the taxes. But if you created one big monopoly metropolitan government, there would no longer be any competition. It would be one big monopoly government, and that's always more costly. And so there's been a lot of statistical studies showing that. So it's a hypothesis that these governments become more monopolistic, more wasteful as they become bigger, and then the hypothesis has been supported by a lot of experience over the years. Although at the same time, if you have a lot of proliferation of smaller governments, they could all be pretty much run by a cartel called the federal government, so that they're all pretty much identical. For example, in the U.S., we have thousands and thousands of post offices. They're everywhere. And so you would think, well, that's a good thing. There's competition. There's lots of post offices. But no, they're all run by one big cartel manager called the U.S. Postal Service. And so local governments, metropolitan areas that have lots of proliferation of local governments, can still be very costly and bureaucratic and not competitive if they're all more or less uniform and run as a cartel by the state governments or by the federal government or by both. Let's see. What else do we have here? How and why does the state have legitimacy? Well, that's part of our discussion for tonight. It's the ideological minions. Give the state legitimacy. They're the ones who make up all the stories about why we need a state. We need a state to protect us from aggressors, even though the state has always been the biggest aggressor. We need a state to protect us from violence, even though the state has always been the perpetrator of the biggest amount of violence by many orders of magnitude. Look at the 20th century, the century of mass murder through warfare, for goodness sake. The state is said to be necessary to protect us from theft, even though the state is by far, in many orders of magnitude, the biggest thief in any country, because taxation is essentially an act of thievery, legalized thievery, and makes it legal for itself. And so the role of the ideological minions is to convince at least the majority of the public that theft, murder, fraud, when done by the government, is not theft, murder, and fraud. It's something else. Kidnapping is called conscription, and you have people, politicians in nice suits standing behind many of their country's flags or in front of many of their country's flags, telling young men, go and sign up for the draft. We don't have a draft in America anymore, but you should sign up for it anyway. My old friend Walter Williams, the economist and syndicated columnist, once said that that's like telling black people in America, you know, we got rid of slavery, but we'd like you to just go and sign up anyway, because we want to know, we'd like to know where you are. You know, we're not going to bring it back, but go and sign up anyway. And that's what Americans today, the U.S. government today, says to 18 and 19-year-old youth, that they still have to sign up for the draft and register, even though there is no draft. And so, in a nutshell, it's the ideological minions that give the state legitimacy. And this includes academics, not all academics, of course, journalists, book authors, you know, newspaper writers, and bloggers, and all people. And of course, these people all, in turn, benefit in some way. The academics and intellectuals, I was told recently by a very reliable source that Paul Krugman, for example, makes $150,000 a speech. You know, it pays to be a court intellectual for the state. You know, you get all kinds of connections. It will pay you lots and lots of money. Not directly from the government, but people in the government will arrange for their friends to hire you at a very good wage to do all sorts of nothing for them. Who would pay $150,000 for a Paul Krugman speech when you can just read his column in the New York Times or for free, where he says the same thing, online? Okay, The Enterprise of Law by Bruce Benson is also an outstanding book. Brendan Traynor mentioned in my comment on the evolution of private law. The Linus is asking, do you think the creation of the state is almost biological, similar to ape social culture? Could our status as the apex species push some to be predatory of fellow humans because of our control over nature? There are always predators in every society. One of the theories of the state, of why we need a state, is that there would be sort of the biggest and most powerful predatory gang of humans that dominates. But that's not necessarily the way things would work. You know, if you look at the way actual history has worked itself out in a lot of eras, different organizations, different countries don't just stand by. If there's a rogue like Napoleon running around trying to conquer the world, it's not always true that all the other states will sit back and let the rogue run over everybody, because they'll all figure we might be next. Maybe we should join an alliance and let this rogue know that he's not going to go any further. And so that's a possibility too, self-defense against this sort of behavior. Oh yeah, this is a great book, a great article by William Hoagland. William Hoagland also wrote an entire book on the Whiskey Rebellion. I see the Mises Institute put the title of the article, Libertarian Socialists and the Whiskey Rebellion. And it's based partly on William Hoagland's book on the Whiskey Rebellion, which is an excellent book on it. Yeah, and also, Rothbard himself wrote an article many years ago on the Whiskey Rebellion. And his article is about how historians lied about it. So the Whiskey Rebellion was a successful tax rebellion. No one was prosecuted, no one went to jail, no one was hanged. Alexander Hamilton wanted to hang all of them. George Washington pardoned everybody, but the historians have lied about it for the most part, not William Hoagland, but other historians, by saying it showed that the government had the power to tax and was willing to enforce that power to tax, but it didn't enforce the Power to Tax. The tax rebels were not put in jail. They were not hanged as Hamilton wanted to do to them. It succeeded. And so Rothbard points this out. It's one of the reasons why I always loved Rothbard. He was not afraid to call out the bullshit artist, to use a technical term, in the economics and the history profession. The apes and chimpanzees, that's not my specialty, so I'm going to pass over those questions. Here's one that says, do you agree with John Hodges that the concept of the rule of law is actually one of the most important concepts that supports the state's legitimacy? The state is always attacked with a genuine rule of law, which is basically understood to be equality under the law. That law should be clear, understandable, and knowable in advance to everyone. But I'm not a big fan of the rule of law, because the laws can be, you can have laws that are clear and understandable and known in advance to everyone that command people to do evil things. And so it depends on what the laws are, not just stable rules per se. But I think Rothbard at one point criticized this, and I can't remember where it was. But one example he gave is, well, what if you had a society that said, here's part of the rule of law, is we think redheads are a menace to society, so every other year we're going to kill 1,000 redheads at random. It's clearly stated, everybody knows in advance what the rule is, it's a rule of law, but it's an evil rule. And so, for that reason, I'm not as convinced as others that this is an important thing. But yeah, it does. It does support the state's supposed legitimacy, that it enforces this rule of law. Well, Hayek was a minarchist, and he certainly believed wrote very eloquently about the rule of law. Yeah, he certainly was a minarchist. See, I'm going to try taking my camera off, away from the computer. I don't know if this makes any difference or not on the noise. Keep reading comments here about the noise. Let's see, Julian, the best example against the economy of scale is going out of the cantons of Switzerland. That's a good point. Let's see, Colin is asking about some books, The State by Oppenheimer and Chodorov, The Rise and Fall of Society. No, they don't cover the same stuff. They're different authors, of course, and I would read The State by Oppenheimer. I mean, it's just a real classic. Still looking for more questions here. Julian Leroy says he read somewhere that half of all economists are employed by the state. It's probably more than that in the United States. I think there was an article by Lawrence White in the Journal of Monetary Economics a few years ago where a very high percentage, I think it was something like 75% or more, of all economists who wrote on the issue of monetary policy are paid in some way by the Fed, either as consultants or full-time employees, part-time employees, in some way, summer fellows, something like that. A lot of good book recommendations by the students. This is great. see. Brian is asking about any books from me. Well, I just came out with one. The Mises Institute published it, called Organized Crime, The Unvarnished Truth About Government. That's my latest publication. And I'm working on one entitled Health of the State, the Politics and Economics of War. So I'm writing a book on war in general, politics and economics of war. I'm going to go back to the chat now. I mean, see if there's any questions in the chat. I mean the Q&A. I've been in the chat. Okay, the question from Ken. Quattlebaum, without government, how can the general public protect itself, i.e. provide what is now police protection? Well, the general public, I had sponsored a speech at my university by Ron Paul a couple of years ago, and one of the comments he made, which was edited out, by the way, by the university bureaucracy, because they thought apparently the students' sensitive ears shouldn't hear this kind of stuff. He said that the main reason why Americans are safe in their homes is not because there are police cars patrolling the neighborhood, but because of the Second Amendment that guarantees them the right to bear arms. And so that is a very, very, very true point. There's a book that was published several years ago in the U.S. entitled Dial 911 and Die. 911 are the numbers for those who are not in the U.S. when you dial your telephone to get the police. And so if you're at the stage where someone has broken into your home and they're armed and they're going to rob or kill you or whatever, it's too late. The cops aren't going to come. And so the police in America, anyway, are primarily, in my view, crime historians. They show up after the crime has been committed and they take a report and they write down the history of the crime, and then they go away and they pretend that they're going to solve it. And they put all these television shows on TV and in the U.S. about these brilliant and unfailing detectives who solve every crime. But most of the time, they just take a report and then use the report to justify getting more money because there's so much crime in the city. And so, we've got self-protection without the government police. This is kind of a question that you could say. If the government had monopolized the shoe industry, Murray Rothbard once said, forever, you can bet your life that people would be asking, well, where would we get shoes? If the government doesn't give us shoes, where are we going to get shoes? And the government, by the way, has not always monopolized the police power. It doesn't today. As I said earlier, there are more private police than there are government police in the U.S. And so we would have to protect ourselves, and we do in a lot of different ways, don't we? We have locks on our doors, we have gated communities, we do all sorts of things. We spend money on electricity, leaving the lights on. We own firearms to protect ourselves. I live in Florida, which is a concealed carry state where it's legal if you apply for a license, if you get it. You're not a felon. You can get a license to carry a concealed firearm with you for your protection. And the economist John Lotz has written several books on this. And his first was entitled More Guns, Less Crime. And he's a very good econometrician, very good statistician. And one of the things he showed is that state after state that passed these concealed carry laws that assaults on individuals just went straight down. He has all the series of graphs in his book showing that once the criminals understood that there's a high probability that these houses have people in them who are armed that can protect themselves, they resort to other types of crimes. They might break into your car parked out in the street, but they're not going to shoot you in your home. And so self-protection is the obvious alternative to relying on the monopoly government police, who, as I said, are essentially crime historians for the most part, at least in the U.S. Uh, Let's see, I'll go back to the chat, see if there's any chatting going on. Linus is an armed society, is a polite society. But I mentioned a quote during the lecture from Benjamin Franklin. Now, the first part of the quote is, democracy is two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for lunch. And the next sentence in the quote says something to the effect that that's why the lamb needs to be heavily armed, so he's not plundered by the wolves. Okay. We have. Colin Wright says, if we have secession down to every man, would that be any different than anarcho-capitalism? No, that would be a free society. That's true. The more the better, as far as I can tell. Let's see, I don't see any more questions here. Yeah, I'll take one more attempt at Q&A, see if there's anything new. We're coming to the end of time here. Let's see, without government, how can the general public protect itself against foreign aggression? Well, the government, you know, who's the biggest foreign aggressor in the world today? It's the U.S. military. It's the perpetrator of foreign aggression. Somebody mentioned Switzerland here a minute ago. Switzerland is, you know, one of the most heavily armed, if not the most heavily armed country in the world, and no one ever messes with Switzerland. Even the Nazis did not invade Switzerland. And so, in terms of foreign aggressors, you know, one of the reasons it was given for the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution by James Madison, who's sort of the acknowledged father of the U.S. Constitution, was he said that a heavily armed society would be a deterrent from invasion by a federal government, a central government in the future. And he must have also had in mind foreign aggressors, because foreign aggressors would also have to be met with a militia. And back in the early days of America, that's how people protected themselves, with local militia. And the local militia could form alliances, state by state by state, to form a large army if they had to. But they did not have a large standing army, because a large standing army is used for all sorts of purposes that have nothing whatsoever to do with defending from foreign aggressors, such as the United States. When was the last time the United States was involved in a war, if it was a defensive war? Murray Rothbard would say the South in the American Civil War. He said this in an article that's on the web entitled Just War. He goes through all the theories of just war, starting with St. Thomas Aquinas and philosophers of that sort, and comes to the conclusion that the only two defensive wars in all of American history were the American Revolution, where Americans fought against an oppressive, thuggish king, and the South in the American Civil War, because it was the South that was invaded, after all, by the U.S. government, and they were fighting off what they considered to be foreign invaders. But all other wars, according to Rothbard, have been aggressive wars. And so, you know, if you want to get rid of aggressive warfare, you get rid of the American military. That's the main source of aggressive warfare in the United States. Of course, the government has done everything it can to terrify young people about guns and firearms. And I mention these topics in audiences, university audiences, at least in Maryland. I can see the looks of the gasping on the faces of the students when you just even mention the possibility that someone might defend themselves with a firearm. Because they've been so propagandized their whole lives, their whole young lives, against the Second Amendment. Well, I think our time is about up. I've got 8 o'clock, and so thank you all for participating. A lot of great questions and a lot of good book suggestions by the class. That's a good omen. That means you're all going to learn a lot if you keep it up. It's not just me that's going to be throwing out book suggestions and reading suggestions. I think it's fun for me to learn and for all of you to learn from one another. So I think we'll call it a night then. And everyone, have a good night. Thanks for participating. See you next week. We'll do the same thing again at 6:30 Eastern Time next Monday.